When I was in middle school, I remember one night, in the middle of the night, I woke up, I was on the top bunk, and I was really, really cold, just chilled to the bone. And the worst thing about it is I remember thinking, the only way to get warmer is to get out of bed, is to get colder first. I'm going to have to lift these covers. So I was laying there just dreading it for as long as possible, and then somehow, I don't remember, I got out of bed and I was standing at my parents' door saying, "I'm so cold." Now, detour. How many of you were at the Ira Glass Performing Arts Series about a month ago? Okay, so in case you don't know, Ira Glass is the host of This American Life, which is a storytelling radio show on NPR. And at that performance, he walked us through a story that they had done about a 13-year-old who was attacked by a shark. So her family was on vacation, and she was swimming off the coast of New Zealand when a shark grabbed her by the torso, shook her like a dog would, and she clawed her way out and got back to shore. Her parents wrapped her up, threw her in the back of the car. They went to the nearest doctor. The doctor stitched her up and said to her parents, "Now, she's a teenager. She's going to be dramatic. She's fine." So that night, they went to their camper, and she wasn't feeling so well. Her parents went to bed, and she was starting to get hot. She was throwing up stomach lining, and she went to her parents and said, "I don't feel so good." And they said, "You're fine. Go back to sleep." So she tried, but man, she was really not feeling well. She went to her parents again. "I really, really don't feel well." And they said, "Mind over matter. Go back to bed." So she was laying there, and she was really starting to feel like the life was draining out of her. She went to her parents and said, "I'm dying." And they said, "You'll be fine. Go back to bed." So at this point, Ira tells us that actually, she was dying. The shark had pierced her lower intestines, which were poisoning her bloodstream. She was undergoing sepsis. We didn't hear the outcome of the story. She lived to tell the tale somehow. But the point that Ira drew from this was, how many times as teenagers do you tell something to your parents like, "Oh, I'm dying"? And this was the epitome. I mean, she really was. And they didn't believe her. So back to my story. I'm standing in front of my parents' door saying, "I am so cold." And the next thing I knew, I was on the couch. My dad was finding blankets and sleeping bags and piling them on top of me. At some point, it was me, blankets, dad, more blankets. He's rubbing my arms to try to create friction. And I remember thinking, well, he's not hot. This has to be so uncomfortable for him, or he's not cold. And then at that point, my fever broke and threw off all the covers. I ended up having pneumonia. I wasn't dying, but I didn't have to be. I didn't have to exaggerate my condition, and I didn't have to beg to be heard. I just said, "I am so cold." And through that extraordinary act of love and many others, I knew that I mattered.
Good morning. Can you hear me? I always have to fight the urge to not dive into the microphone. So my name is Chris Clausen. Many of you probably know me through Sarah Clausen. She and I are in the early years of our partnership together. And it took me like 30 minutes to write that sentence. Because in the early years of a partnership together, you have to navigate many things, and one of those is, what do you call your partnership? Like, are we courting? What does that mean? Are we dating? I don't know. So I ran it by her and got the thumbs up. Something else that we recently navigated was the meeting of our parents. So my family's from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and they came down to Goshen last weekend, and if you were in assembly, you would have met them. So this was not the first time that Sarah had met my parents, but it was the first time that my parents were meeting Sarah's parents, which we felt was a big deal. And so in the weeks leading up, parents were like our primary topic of conversation. And we started playing this game called Worst Case Scenario. And it would go like something like, what if my dad starts making like dad jokes all the time? Or what if he starts making wild generalizations about America based on your current election and your parents like get super offended because this is Goshen? And I don't know, like all these things that could happen. And we realized that it was pretty silly. Our parents have been handling social situations their whole life. It's probably going to be fine. And then the conversation sort of took a funny turn, and we started just sort of mentioning observations that we had about our parents' personalities. And so one part of our conversation sort of went like this. I was, you know, anticipating Sarah and I being with my parents this weekend and them sort of being on vacation, and I was remembering how when I was young and I went on vacation with my dad, he wore this, like, bright blue backpack all the time and a Tilly hat. It didn't matter what we were doing. And we always felt like, wow, just screams tourist. Like, Dad, come on. Like, I don't know, wear something normal or something like that. And Sarah pointed out to me, like, remember that time we were in Indianapolis and you wanted to take Segway tours and wear green helmets and, like, wave at everyone? And I was like, you have a good point, you know? There are certainly some similarities there. And I said something else, like, one thing that bothers me about my dad is if something bothers him, he has the most indirect way of approaching it. I'm like, oh, that just drives me nuts. And Sarah's like, dude, that's what you do. And yeah, in the early years of a partnership, you learn all these things about each other, and you start noticing how influential your parents have been in your lives. And for me specifically, my father has shaped me a lot. Let me find myself here. So, our parents met, and it was lovely. It went really well. Of course it did. They're all lovely people. The last day of our visit, we went to Chicago together. Sarah, me, and my parents, we all went to Chicago. And we started our day with an architectural boat tour along the river in Chicago, which is really awesome. I highly recommend it. We were baked in the sun, and so after the tour, we decided to go look for some shade in Navy Pier. But before we got into Navy Pier, we found this fountain outside Navy Pier, and there's probably like a dozen or so kids running around in the fountain. And I was thinking, like, wow, I'm so hot. We should just go run around in this fountain with these kids. And I turned to my dad to suggest that, and he's already got his shoes and socks off. And he's like slapping me on the back, and he's like, come on, Christopher, let's go play in the fountain. And Sarah and I joined him, and like, we had a blast. It was awesome. And so in this last week, I've been thinking about what to say about my dad, and I keep coming back to that memory of him patting me on the back and saying, come on, Christopher, let's go play. And I think that that stands out because I have hundreds of memories just like that. My dad slapping me on the back and saying, like, let's go play together. It's only in the last few years that I sort of recognize my dad's gift of play. And so that's, you know, the one thing I'd like to tell you about is my father's gift of play. And what I realize more and more are all the virtues that are wrapped up in that gift of play. When my dad plays, he explores his environment, he problem solves, he improvises, his sense of humor shines, and these are all virtues that I so, so admire and love in him. And I'm so grateful for the example that he has been to me, and that at 58 years old, he's still the first one into the fountain. Thank you.
I had to bring my handkerchief because this is a little difficult. My name is Barb Hassan. My father, Leonard Eads, was an avid hunter, a hobby he enjoyed until his lung cancer diagnosis and early death at age 54. Now, I truly don't know when he started hunting. Perhaps he began due to his early life circumstances. Second born of seven children, dirt poor, always hungry, an absent father. My grandma, Effie, took in ironing, but the family had almost no steady income. And this was a time before the Depression, with no social programs existing to help family stability. The county home, as it was known, or the county poorhouse, was less than a mile away from the home of my father and his family. After his death, some folks said he began hunting to prevent his family from moving there. Story told to me was that my dad and his brother Clacy would sell their bounty close to the site of the hunt, and all of the money was given to their mother Effie for the family. My dad continued hunting after his marriage, and needless to say, when I was a little girl, I too wanted to be a hunter, just like my dad. However, there was a big conflict. Optimal hunting time was Sunday mornings about 6:30 a.m., and the hunting sites were pretty far away. My mom, Rosie, was the kindergarten Sunday school teacher at the First EUB Church in Elkhart on Hickory Street, and she was not happy that my father indicated, of course I could go hunting with him. You see, my dad never went to church. My mom and sister and I went, but he told me later that he never wanted to go to church again because he had been ridiculed in church when he and his family attended. Their clothes were not considered good enough, and there was no father in the house, and you know what that means. But I digress. I was able to go hunting with my father, and those times were filled with joy. Not only was I able to ride in the front seat of the car, but I could wear boots, my long jeans, and carry a big cloth bag in which all our bounty would be placed. My dad always put the other hunting gear in the trunk of the car. Bug spray, because there were lots of bugs. A little tiny bottle of immune ivy, which we would drink to prevent us from catching poison ivy. Gloves, a rag, and an odd long-handled stick with a cup-like attachment on the end. My dad would also throw in hip-high wading boots. My excitement rose as we left Elkhart, usually heading for the environs of Syracuse and Wawasee. We'd park our car off the road, and the hunt began. As we walked along, my dad would point out objects in nature and talk with me about them. So as a little girl, I saw snakes and chipmunks, frogs and toads, lots of unfamiliar plants, and I wasn't afraid of them. Once we got close to what looked like a big pond, my dad would put on his wading boots. Stick in hand, he would walk into the water, and in no time, our bag was full. And we would go back to the car for a drink. He would always have coffee, and I would have hot cocoa. As I remember those days, my heart is warmed. And I remember them often, especially when I see one of these. You see, the object of my dad's hunting was golf balls. For years, he washed, resorted, and sold golf balls to most of the golfers in Elkhart. He also bought a striping machine from Bobik's in Chicago, striped the balls for local driving ranges, and sold them. One driving range was the Corral Restaurant and Driving Range, which was between Elkhart and Goshen. John is shaking his head. I would go there with him, and we would eat huge, gigantic tenderloin sandwiches, which today I really can't eat. But it was wonderful. All of this occurred due to the determination, dedication, and discipline of my father. I like to think that those are qualities that he left to me. Happy Father's Day, Daddy. I love you.
The summer after I finished eighth grade, my dad and I departed for what is now a well-established tradition, the father-daughter boundary water canoe trip. Do you want to come up too? You could probably do this trip at any time and it would be worthwhile, but the summer after eighth grade, when I was just heading into the tumult of my adolescent years and the parental tension that sometimes accompanied it, that seems to me like a rare window. A chance for daughters and fathers to see each other as partners instead of adversaries. That may not be true for everyone, but I think it was for us. Of course, it wasn't just me and my dad on the trip. We were accompanied by Sarah and John Bowman, who made the long trip from Boston to join us, Becca and Steve Schantz, and Abby and John Nafziger, and also a guide whose name and face I cannot remember, but about whom I have good feelings. We were a lively crew. The night before we left for the Boundary Waters, we had a short worship service at the Wilderness Wind Base Camp. And whoever it was that was doing the homily spoke about how we tend to put people into boxes. And if we allow people out of those boxes, we might be surprised what we see. That was the gist of it, at least. And anyway, that message took root in me during the week. And I was surprised what I saw of my dad. I knew that he was a capable adult. A physician, a musician, a frisbee enthusiast. And yet, seeing him hoist a canoe on his back and portage it by himself, as well as his own heavy pack, was impressive. I actually didn't realize how heavy those canoes were until I helped carry them myself on a later trip to the Boundary Waters with the NYF. Nobody was carrying my canoe then. I knew that my dad was a hard worker with a penchant for cleanliness. But seeing him really scraping the bottle of the oatmeal pot clean and then going at it with the dirt and pine needles, that was unprecedented. He really committed. I distinctly remember Steve Schantz catching one of those cleaning sessions on videotape and my dad yelling, "Stop taping me! I'm a three!" Whatever that means. I still haven't gotten into the Enneagram. But I knew it was funny. I knew he was funny. When it was discovered that we had left the pancake flipper back at the base camp, my innovative father attempted to whittle one out of a stick. I think it was a mixed success. He was patient and directive with me as we worked together in the canoe, he steering at the back and me rowing at the front. He was actually way better at teaching me to canoe than he would be at teaching me to drive a few years later. Less pressure, I guess. I don't know. We made a good team. I also wonder what it was like for him to see me, apart from my sisters, for a whole week. Did he discover things about me he hadn't noticed before? At one point in the week, Sarah and I got lost on a day hike when just the two of us took a wrong turn. It couldn't have been more than a couple of hours, and we were camped on an island, but we were pretty scared. We kept blowing our emergency whistles, and no one was finding us. I was checking this story with Sarah Bowman on Facebook this week, and she remembers it being one of the few times in her life when she thought she might die. She was a city girl. We were stuck on an island. Things looked bad. Somehow, we made it back again. I actually don't remember the details. And, of course, my dad doesn't remember them either. But, amazingly, my memories from that trip don't include the terror of getting lost. Mostly the takeaway from that week was a lingering sense that my dad was an interesting and fun person. A person who had an identity apart from just being my dad. He was that, and a really good one. But for the first time, I could see him as more than that also. And I'm grateful that stayed with me.